majority of the Israeli population to the occupation is what led and keeps leading to this ongoing and increasingly violent confrontation between Israel and the Palestinians.
Professor Omer Bartov, we're going to continue with part two of our conversation posted at democracynow.org. Brown University Professor of Holocaust and Genocide Studies, called by the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum one of the world's leading specialists on the subject of genocide. And Marion Ingram, 87-year-old Holocaust survivor, about to turn 88. We thank you for sharing your experience. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
This is Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, and this is KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio just wrapped up our annual fall membership drive. Support from listeners like you helped us reach our goal, gain new members, and prepared us to bring you more organic, homegrown, fresh-off-the-vine community radio. Thanks to all those who donated during this drive, and thanks to those who listened in. Stay tuned for more.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, two other PPS unions request mediation amid the Portland teachers' strike.
Midterm election results are in, and abortion rights win the day.
And a Multnomah County judge considers putting the brakes on enforcing the so-called daytime camping ban.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, November 8th, 2023. I'm Althea Billings.
And I'm Reed Johnson. As the Portland Public Schools teachers strike enters its fifth day, two further unions representing PPS employees have filed for mediation with the district. SEIU 503 and Portland Federation of School Professionals, or PFSP, filed on Friday requests for mediation with the Oregon Employment Relations Board. SEIU 503 represents PPS nutrition services and custodial workers, and PFSP represents school employees, including administrative staff and paraprofessionals. Together, the unions represent over 2,000 employees. Both unions are now able to access outside assistance to reach an agreement with the district. In the event of a failed agreement, mediation may turn to a future strike. Employees represented by these unions have worked with expired labor contracts since June. A major grievance with the unions is pay, and members say progress hasn't been made at the bargaining table. SEIU 503 reports most PPS cafeteria staff make under $24,000 a year. PFSP has also filed a grievance against PPS last week amidst the teacher strike. They claim the district asked educators to compensate for teachers' absences by performing work outside of their contracts.
Tuesday's midterm elections provided victories for abortion rights supporters and others. Nearly 60% of Ohio voters approved adding abortion protection into the state's constitution. Ohio also became the 24th state to legalize recreational marijuana. In Virginia, Democrats maintain control of the state Senate and took control of the House of Delegates. This will allow them to reject Republican Governor Glenn Youngkin's conservative agenda, including a ban on abortions after 15 weeks. In Kentucky, Democrat Andy Beshear won a second term as governor, defeating an anti-abortion Republican. In Philadelphia, Sherelle Parker will be the city's 100th mayor and the first woman to hold that job. Over in New York City, Yusuf Salam, one of the wrongly imprisoned and later exonerated Central Park Five, was elected to city council.
Tuesday was election day in most of the U.S., and many of the results are in. In moments, we'll hear more on Ohio's vote to put abortion rights into the state's constitution, plus incumbent governors prevail in Kentucky and Mississippi, and Rhode Island sends a first black representative to Congress. With more on these stories, it's Catherine Carley with 2023 Talks.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
They underestimated Ohio. And they have awakened a sleeping giant.
Kelly Copeland of Pro-Choice Ohio is hailing the vote to amend abortion rights into the state's constitution. The passing of Issue 1 will undo a ban on abortions at around 6 weeks and will create legal protections for anyone helping someone get reproductive care. Since Roe was overturned last year, voters have backed abortion rights in 6 states, including Kansas and Kentucky. Democratic Governor Andy Beshear has defied the odds again, winning a second term in deep red Kentucky, in part by dodging partisan labels.
A good job as a Democrat or Republican. A new bridge in red or blue.
Beshear beat Republican Daniel Cameron, the state's first black nominee from a major party. In Mississippi, first-term Governor Tate Reeves looks likely to have won re-election, continuing Republican dominance of that state's government.
Mississippi has momentum, and this is Mississippi's time, and we're looking forward to working for the people of Mississippi for 4 more years.
Reeves' Democratic opponent sought to highlight the governor's connection to a public corruption scandal, the misuse of nearly $80 million in welfare funds. Reeves denies any wrongdoing and ran on the largest tax cut in state history and raising teacher pay. Every seat in the Virginia General Assembly was on Tuesday's ballot. It looks unlikely that Republican Governor Glenn Youngkin will have the legislature he would need to enact a 15-week abortion ban, although Youngkin still plans to work on his agenda.
We're moving forward in order to build a better Virginia, and we're the party of hope, and hope beats fear every day of the week.
Results in Virginia, Kentucky, Ohio, and Pennsylvania may foreshadow next year's congressional and White House races and will give clues about turnout. In Pennsylvania, voters sent another judge to the state Supreme Court. The race doesn't change the Democratic majority there, but signals implications for the future of voting and abortion rights in a battleground state. Sherelle Parker, a seasoned state politician who promised Philadelphia residents she would crack down on crime, will be the city's first woman mayor.
I didn't pull myself up by my bootstraps. There was a community and a village of people who lifted me up.
Rhode Island is sending its first black representative to Congress. Democrat Gabe Amo won the special election after the resignation of a 7-term congressman.
When I was 8 years old helping my mother study for the citizenship test, I never could have imagined that I would go with her to cast her ballot to vote for her son for the United States.
And Maine voters look likely to have banned foreign governments from making campaign contributions in state elections, but not approved the transfer of ownership of the state's 2 largest private utilities to the public. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
A Multnomah County judge will rule tomorrow on whether to pause the enforcement of Portland's controversial daytime camping ban. Mayor Ted Wheeler announced the June ban would start being enforced on November 13th. It's facing a lawsuit on state constitutional grounds. A group of homeless Portlanders filed a class action lawsuit against it in early October. They allege that the camping restrictions violate Oregon law and the state constitution because they subject people who are involuntarily homeless to unreasonable punishments for unavoidable activities. Punishments include fines and jail time. The unavoidable activities they can be punished for: sleeping and staying warm and dry. If the judge chooses it, the pause would allow the legal challenge to proceed through the courts.
And in further local news, Portland City Council has voted to extend their control over city bureaus. Transitioning their control over those bureaus to city administrators had been a major focus of the city's charter transition team and of Mayor Ted Wheeler. The new charter takes effect January 1st, 2025, and Wheeler had wanted to get an interim city administrator and deputy city administrators hired by no later than July 2024. Last week, the council approved Commissioner Renee Gonzalez's amendment that council would keep control over their bureaus until the end of 2024. Wheeler called the change, quote, inconsistent with the transition goals, end quote, and questioned whether or not the whole transition process should be scrapped. Last month, Gonzalez and Commissioners Dan Ryan and Carmen Rubio also suggested in a memo to the city finance and administration offices that commissioners themselves be the deputy city administrators in the new system. The charter amendments are designed to address a lack of collaboration and demographic representation in city government and to improve efficiency.
The House of Representatives has censured Michigan Representative Rashida Tlaib by a vote of 234 to 188. The censure resolution falsely accuses Tlaib of defending the Hamas attack as justified resistance and calling for the destruction of the State of Israel. Before the vote, Tlaib told Congress, quote, "There are millions of people across our country who oppose Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's extremism and are done watching our government support collective punishment and the use of white phosphorus bombs that melt flesh to the bone." She continued, quote, "The idea that criticizing the government of Israel is anti-Semitic sets a very dangerous precedent, and it's being used to silence diverse voices speaking up for human rights across our nation," end quote. The majority of the votes for her censure were Republicans. 22 Democrats voted for the censure, and 4 Republicans voted against it. Oregon's congressional delegation voted along party lines.
Federal, tribal, and Arizona state leaders have announced the implementation of 7 new conservation agreements in Arizona, which they say will help conserve water through 2026. Alex Gonzalez has more on the story.
Arizona leaders are celebrating the federal government's just over $63 million investment for water conservation, efficiency, and protection of the Colorado River. It's the latest move by the Biden-Harris administration to address the growing water scarcity in the Southwest. Last week, 7 Arizona water users announced their agreements to voluntarily reduce their water consumption. Together, the agreements are expected to conserve almost 163,000 acre-feet of water in Lake Mead through 2026. Arizona Governor Katie Hobbs says water conservation and economic growth in the state go hand in hand.
Which is exactly what I have called for when saying that every water user in every sector, in every state needs to be a part of the Colorado River solution. This is a major feat and a great step forward in securing our state's water future for generations to come.
Hobbs says she knew Arizona was at a crossroads when she took office, and one of her goals is to make Arizona's growing economy more sustainable. The new agreements build on a proposal made by the Biden-Harris administration last month to conserve at least 3 million acre-feet of Colorado River system water through 2026. The parties that have entered into the conservation agreements are composed of water districts, Native American tribes, and one farm. In total, there are now 18 agreements in Arizona, and they commit the various water users to conserving up to almost 350,000 acre-feet of water in Lake Mead in 2023, and just shy of 1 million acre-feet through 2026. Bureau of Reclamation Commissioner Camille Tootin says addressing the drought crisis requires an all-hands-on-deck approach.
The voluntary system conservation agreements demonstrate Reclamation's approach to addressing the challenges of climate change and drought through science-based innovative strategies.
Tootin adds the Bureau is working to finalize additional agreements. Through the bipartisan infrastructure law, it will be investing another $8.3 billion over 5 years for water infrastructure, including water purification and reuse, storage, desalination, and dam safety. For Arizona News Connection, I'm Alex Gonzalez.
The state of California has recently approved 3 proposed ballot initiatives restricting transgender youth in schools. Suzanne Potter reports.
3 proposed ballot initiatives affecting transgender students are now in the signature gathering stage in California. The group Protect Kids California says it is planning to combine them to try to get one big measure on the ballot next fall. One proposal would prevent transgender girls from competing on girls' sports teams in school. Jonathan Zacherson is a co-founder of Protect Kids California.
It's not fair where biological boys are able to enter into girls' sports based off of the gender that they identify as. And so girls are losing scholarships, they're losing opportunities to play, and in some cases, they're being injured.
That proposal would also require schools to limit boys' restrooms to students born male and girls' restrooms to students born female. LGBTQ plus groups argue that forcing a transgender child into a different restroom puts that student at risk of harassment or violence. Another initiative would require schools to notify parents if a student presents as a different gender or requests a new name or pronoun. Earlier this year, the school board in Chino tried to pass a similar policy, but a judge declared it unconstitutional and blocked it. Tony Wong is executive director at Equality California.
In an ideal world, all LGBTQ plus students will live in an affirming and supportive home. But unfortunately, we know that not all do. And in some circumstances, forcibly outing students can cause significant harm and potentially violence.
A third proposal would ban medical providers from offering gender-affirming care to minors, including puberty-blocking medication, cross-sex hormonal treatment, mastectomies, or genital surgery. Amanda Goad with the ACLU of Southern California notes these therapies are approved by the American Medical Association and the American Academy of Pediatrics.
The proponents of these measures sometimes make them out to be efforts to protect kids. That really offends me, given that that care reduces trans youth's risks of suicide and benefits their ability to live their lives and figure out who they are.
For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with Kay Rambo, editor-in-chief at Street Roots, about the new article, Homeless Portlanders and Service Providers Prepare for November 13th Sleeping Ban Enforcement While the Mayor's Office Dodges Questions. Then at 5:45, it's News from the Boo, your look at the news inside KBOO. At 6, it's Keeping Democracy Alive. Then at 7, Exploration with Michio Kaku. Tonight's weather will be clear with a low of 42. Tomorrow's weather will likely be rainy with a high of 51. Today in history, in 1847, Irish author Bram Stoker was born. He's best known for writing the gothic horror novel Dracula. The quote of the day is from Canadian-American game show host Alex Trebek, who died on this day in 2020. He said, quote, "It's very important in life to know when to shut up. You should not be afraid of silence."
Native actor and activist Dallas Goldtooth spoke at a Harvard conference on their legacy of mistreatment, speaking candidly about the artifacts that they still house. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. As part of a larger effort to reckon with its historical ties to slavery and other atrocities, Harvard recently held an event looking at its legacy of mistreatment of indigenous people. The Mountain West News Bureau's Murphy Woodhouse reports.
Dakota and Dene actor, comedian, and activist Dallas Goldtooth is well known for his role in the acclaimed series Reservation Dogs. He did not mince words in his keynote at the Responsibility and Repair Conference. Harvard's massive collection of Native American remains came up often.
Y'all had the audacity to do a report, name a whole conference Legacies of Indigenous Enslavement and Indenture, and you still got bodies in the buildings? Man, you guys are saucy.
He says the work that led up to Reservation Dogs taught him about the power of collective action.
Accountability is not an individual task necessarily when we're talking about social injustice and the harm perpetuated by institutions. It is a collective task that we as individuals take responsibility for. Institutions like Harvard cannot undo the harm of the past until it stops the harm that it is doing today.
I'm Murphy Woodhouse.
The fourth season of the show Native Shorts, presented by Sundance Institute's Indigenous Films Program, which airs on FNX TV, is now in production. KNBA's Jill Freitas has more.
The show focuses on short Indigenous films from around the world. Bird Running Water, who is Mescalero Apache and Northern Cheyenne, is film curator and host. He has also worked with Sundance's Native American and Indigenous program for more than 20 years. Host Ariel Tweedo is a Inupiaq. She connects with the everyday viewer, asking questions that the audience might have about the film. Tweedo says they have a lengthy process to choose which episodes air on the show.
I mean, we want a diverse array of films or genres, and so they'll find a horror, a romance, a like comedy, something very abstract, and so they want to get films from like all over.
From New Zealand to Australia to the Aleutian Chain of Alaska, Indigenous filmmakers share stories of their cultures and ways of life. Tweedo says she notices a lot of differences from one continent to the next.
Just to see how other people live or other viewpoints of living is, I think, really special. I've learned a lot just about different cultures from around the world, and so I think that's really cool, and different ways of storytelling. How someone in New Zealand tells a story a lot different than someone, say, from Finland. And just it's cool to see the diversity.
Tweedo says Native Shorts is a great platform to showcase short films, when in the past it was only shown at film festivals.
It's so cool that we get to showcase the short films, because there's not really a platform for short films after festivals. So usually if it's not in a festival, it's just, I don't even know where it goes. So this is just a really cool opportunity for us to showcase all these amazing Indigenous filmmakers and actors and actresses. I've learned a lot just about different cultures from around the world.
Production of Native Shorts Season 4 will wrap up on November 15th with a series premiere on November 30th on FNX. I'm Jill Freitas.
The U.S. Senate Committee on Indian Affairs is holding a hearing on fentanyl and Native communities. Senators will hear from tribal leaders and Native health experts about its impacts and also learn about some tools being used to address the crisis. The hearing is taking place Wednesday in Washington, D.C. Wilma Mankiller is the newest addition to the Barbie Inspiring Women series. Barbie is recognizing the Cherokee Nation leader in advance of her birthday on November 18th. Mankiller was the first female principal chief of the Cherokee Nation. According to the Cherokee Nation, a special event to celebrate the release of the Barbie is being scheduled for a future date in Tahlequah. The doll is available for purchase online at the Mattel shop. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
A new report shows how toxic chemicals in the air, water, and soil amount to stealing kids' future successes. Eric Gladys has more.
Children of color and from low-income families in Colorado and across the nation are not only exposed to more dangerous toxic chemicals, including lead, tailpipe, and other air pollution, plastics, and pesticides, they also experience disproportionate harm to brain development compared to their white and higher-income peers, according to a new report. Co-author Devin Payne Sturges says 5 decades of data shows that poverty exacerbates these impacts.
Studies have found that the combined experience, say, of exposure to lead in the environment and being from an impoverished community or a low-income family actually worsened the negative cognitive impacts.
Americans of all ages are exposed to some level of toxins in the air, water, and soil, but children are especially vulnerable to exposures that can make it harder for them to thrive as adults. Kids whose brains are damaged by these chemicals find it harder to concentrate in class, to recall lessons learned, and are more likely to fail and repeat grades. Payne Sturges says interventions such as replacing lead pipes that bring drinking water into homes are important, but she says counting on people to avoid exposure at the individual level won't work because toxins are found in so many places and products people use every day. She says policies are needed at the national level to address the cumulative public health impacts.
If you're really wanting to ensure that kids grow up in a healthy environment that's also good for their brain development, we need a strategy that addresses these contaminants all together.
Payne Sturges says it's also important to look at how pollutants end up where children live. She says communities of color are not simply making bad decisions about where to raise families. Unhealthy environments are a result of decisions made by industry leaders and government policies.
And it has a long history related to discriminatory practices, residential segregation that forced people only to live in certain places that often happen to be places where polluting industries would site.
This is Eric Gladys for the Colorado News Connection.
The Biden administration has released a proposed rule to ensure that financial advisors, brokers, and insurance agents who sell retirement investments and advice do so in the best interest of their clients, not their own best interest. Tramell Gomes reports.
The Biden administration has proposed a rule to help people save more in retirement and avoid junk fees from unscrupulous financial advisors. According to the White House, a financial advisor may receive a commission as high as 6.5% to recommend some insurance products, posing a conflict of interest. After 36 years of service as an educator, Melandia Franklin Corpus finally reached her retirement milestone last May. But as soon as she filed for retirement 6 months prior, she said a flood of calls and solicitations started to pour in from financial advisors pitching retirement services and plans with few details.
One guy called me and it was almost a pressure sale type thing, you know. This offer is only going to be good for this week, blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, no, I don't make a commitment based on that. Please send me some information. Let me look at it.
While Corpus avoided falling into a bad situation, she said a friend who retired right before went into an investment without realizing he couldn't touch his funds for 5 years without penalty. The new proposal is intended to standardize the rules for everyone paid to offer retirement advice and sell retirement products. A statement from the Insured Retirement Institute attacked Biden's proposal, claiming the fiduciary rule will harm the very consumers he wants to help and deepen the nation's retirement crisis by limiting access to sound financial advice. Existing fiduciary rules from the Employee Retirement Income Security Act and the Securities and Exchange Commission do not comprehensively cover all investment products, such as one-time rollovers from a 401k to an IRA. Corpus says the new protections are a step in the right direction and should expand to all consumers.
An advisor should never be recommending something to any client, regardless of their status, based on his commission. So I think retirees definitely, but I think it should be across the board.
The White House uses the investment product fixed index annuities as an example of where junk fees may cost savers as much as $5 billion annually. Meanwhile, the Insured Retirement Institute claims Biden and the Department of Labor showed a fundamental misunderstanding of how the insurance industry and annuity products work for the benefit of consumers and offer to provide education and information. The proposal is open for public comment for 60 days before any potential revisions are made. This is Tramell Gomes for Florida News Connection.
Canadian adjunct professors have better working conditions than their peers in the United States. These poor working conditions could be affecting the education U.S. adjuncts are able to provide to their students. Eric Tagedoff has more.
Adjunct professors at universities and colleges in the United States are struggling. Their Canadian counterparts are treated better for their work, and that benefits students. John Marcus, higher education editor with the Hechinger Report, says Canadian adjuncts enjoy a number of perks. On average, they're paid about $7,000 per course, nearly twice as much as in the United States, and typically have teaching assistants. Marcus says there are other aspects that make their jobs easier, too.
They have government health insurance, which is an important benefit that most American adjuncts don't have. They also have job security. They are under contracts that give them a few terms at a time in advance of when they teach, where in America, adjuncts essentially teach one semester at a time.
Many adjuncts in the United States struggle to make ends meet. The American Federation of Teachers found nearly 1 in 4 earn below the federal poverty level for a family of four. Marcus says the conditions in the United States affect students.
How much time adjuncts can spend with students. They don't have office hours. They don't have teaching assistants. They are under a lot of stress themselves. All of these things, this new research suggests, has a negative impact on students.
Marcus says it's useful to compare the conditions of Canadian and American adjuncts.
What it suggests is that from the experience of the Canadian adjuncts, it is possible to provide additional support to adjunct faculty, and that support gets paid forward to the students.
For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
KBOO News poet Dan Raphael knows he shouldn't stare directly at the future, but...
Netanyahu says Israel will control Gaza for an indefinite period as the Israeli government continues to treat the Palestinians the way the Nazis treated their grandparents, Gaza becoming one big prison camp. While the past repeats itself, the future is already here. A year from the election, the New York Times and others have declared Trump the victor. No one's interested in the Trumpless Republican debates, and no Democrats are debating Biden because the Democratic Party knows listening to the majority will mean big donors stopping the cash flow. I wish we had the option to vote for none of the above and to throw the election wide open beyond the two wings of the business party. I fear dangerous things could happen before next November. Expansion of the Israeli-Palestinian war, escalation in Ukraine, a harsh winter magnified by famine, some cataclysm we've never seen before, putting the sideshow we call an election into a more humbling perspective. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, November 8th, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories, tips, and quips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Chris Gao, Dan Raphael, and myself. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Ray Bodwell. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Eric Tagadoff, Catherine Carley, Alice Gonzalez, Suzanne Potter, Tramel Gomes, and Eric Galatis. The director of Evening News is also Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Reed Johnson.
And I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members, lovely people like you. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm here with Kay Rambo, editor-in-chief at Street Roots, talking about their new article. It's called Feeling the Squeeze: Homeless Portlanders and Service Providers Prepare for November 13th Sleeping Ban Enforcement While the Mayor's Office Dodges Questions. Welcome to the show, Kay.
Hey, Althea, how are you?
I'm doing all right. How are you?
Oh, not too bad.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us about this today. This new piece of yours delves into, like I mentioned, the so-called daytime camping ban that the city council passed in June, and all that the public and maybe even city council don't know yet about how it's going to be enforced starting on November 13th. As we kind of get into this, can you give us a refresher on what that camping ban says?
The daytime portion of it, like you said, it's kind of been called the daytime camping ban a lot, but that is really just a one portion of the ban. At any time, it prohibits sleeping on, from what we can tell right now, potentially all public property. If not, it is a very large portion of it. You know, it's any parks, sidewalks, near waterways, busy streets, sanctioned encampments, near construction sites, near schools, near medical facilities. You know, the amount of room in the city that's public property that doesn't fit in that